and then vilified for it. Maybe that's why he took my hand into his and clasped it tight. Especially as you have suffered so many losses, Eliza. Though my eyes missed it at his sympathy, I swallowed back my grief lest it consume me. I do not forget that others have suffered too. I was so sorry to hear of your daughter's passing. Max shook his head but squeezed my hand tighter. An ailment of the lungs it was. Nothing I could do for her. And your eldest daughter? He inquired delicately, for he was privy to Anna's troubles. Have they found a cure for her? No, I said, my heart bleeding even as I resigned myself to it. We still visit Anna, but she no longer recognizes us. She's trapped in the past, but at least she's happy there. That is a consolation, he agreed, gazing at me with sympathy. And then we both managed a bittersweet smile. Do you ever... He broke off, then forced himself to start again. You're still very handsome, you know. Bright and lively as ever. I flushed to receive such a compliment in my 52nd year. But Max's purpose was not to flatter. In my younger days, I argued the equality of the sexes, he said. But the world is more difficult for women now, I think. Have you never considered marrying again? Some quiet, lazy man of inherited wealth who knows nothing of politics or war? Or a fat, funny fellow to talk nothing to you but business and bagatelles? I laughed. Of course I laughed. But I realized there was a serious question beneath the jest. Mac was the only person ever to dare ask, and maybe the only person who could ask. He'd been witness to our courtship, attended our wedding. He knew how much I loved Alexander and only wanted happiness for me. And having contributed to the secret trust fund that had enabled the survival of my family, he understood, too, all the ways in which a new husband might secure for me an easier existence. But I remembered what I said to Alexander when he professed jealousy, that I should wear a pendant with Washington's name near my heart. Near to my heart, but not inside it. For there is room there for no man but you. That was still true. And in answer to Max's question, I didn't hesitate. With a shake of my head, I said, no, I could never consent to remarry. There could never be another man for me. How could there be? I hadn't married a man. I'd married a mythic hero who'd driven a carriage of the sun across the sky. No other husband could ever measure up, and it would be cruel to make any man try. I understand, Mac replied with a sympathetic sigh. I only hope to divert you from tilting at windmills. You think I'm a fool? A romantic Don Quixote tilting at windmills. I smiled to hear the echo of my husband's words. Well, since Hamilton cannot tilt any longer, those of us who loved him must do it for him. Then this is just the place to do it, Max said as we crossed a bridge over the eastern branch of the Potomac. Welcome to Washington, Mrs. Hamilton. Our nation's capital was not yet a city, at least not to my eyes. It was little more than a loose collection of urban landmarks laid upon a rural landscape, with wide, muddy lanes, a jarringly humble place for the seat of a federal government. Nothing so grand as Philadelphia or New York or even Baltimore. And only two sections of the proposed congressional building were complete. There was no dome, as you'd see today. And yet, I couldn't help but wonder what Alexander would have thought of this place. Would my husband have seen the potential in the half-finished buildings and the architecture that recalled the ancients he loved so well? Or would he think it a clumsy, monstrous effort built upon the backs of the Negro slaves we saw in wretched circumstances upon every street corner? Given that Jefferson had ruled over the city for 8 long years, It didn't surprise me to find no monuments, statues, or even placards honoring my husband. But I searched in vain for even the equestrian statue that was supposed to have been erected in honor of George Washington. Not enough funds for it, I was told by a passerby. And I was to hear that refrain again at least 100 more times as we paid call upon legislators one by one, asking them to take up the cause of reinstating my husband's benefits. I'm sorry, Mrs. Hamilton, there aren't enough funds for it. Perhaps that was true, since the most rabid Republicans always denied the reality that a government requires tax money to accomplish anything. And yet they'd found the funds to refurbish and decorate the president's mansion. I believed it wasn't the expense that prevented them from granting my husband's benefits. It was the resistance of enemies who insisted, even now, that Alexander had never truly been American. The Republicans won't give an inch, Mac admitted after having spoken to a few friends on my behalf. They might make an exception for another hero of the Revolution. They'd feel a pang of sympathy in their hearts. But not Hamilton. Not Hamilton. Not the so-called arch-intriguer, grandmaster of mischief and evil genius of America, who had dared to forge a strong central government at the expense of the states. Thank you, Mac, I said, trying to remain serene while sipping at my tea in the quiet of the boarding house parlor where we sat together. Unfortunately, I'm long accustomed to the hostility of these Jacobins, or Democratic Republicans, whatever they're calling themselves now. Even New York has become infested with them. And they were so afraid my husband's ideas might flourish that they were willing to deny me my widow's pension. I didn't know whether to be disgusted or pleased that even in his grave, my dear Hamilton remained, in the minds of many, a dangerous man. So I was surprised when Mac murmured, "It's actually the Federalists that are your trouble." Startled, I set down my teacup before I dropped it. "The Federalists?" Mac rubbed his sore knee, seemingly unable to meet my eyes. "There are those who still blame Hamilton for our party's collapse. We've lost 3 presidential elections in a row." And how precisely could that be my husband's fault? Even his reach does not extend beyond the grave. "It does," Mac explained. "They blame Hamilton for revealing that John Adams is a bit of a madman. They think he cost us the presidency. Then he gave it to Jefferson. Nearly all of the party leaders fear that so long as the Federalists are associated with your husband, we can never win another election, so they won't take up your cause. They'd rather be the party of George Washington, and they fear you're going to spoil it for them." I took up my teacup again, with disdain. "By reminding the world that Hamilton existed." He shook his head. "The rumor in Federalist circles is that you're trying to revive your husband's legacy at Washington's expense." That was preposterous and deeply offensive. A malicious lie. How could I do such a thing, even if it were my aim? "It's said that you intend to claim in your husband's forthcoming biography that Hamilton wrote Washington's farewell address." "He did write it. With the president's notes, of course. How could that possibly put Washington in a bad light? You were an aide-de-camp, too. Did the letters you wrote for the man take away from his greatness?" Mac raised his hands. "It's not me you have to convince." I knew that. Mac had not only scoured his attic for Hamilton's papers, but ridden, or at least rolled, into battle with me here in Washington City. And yet, we had not found even one congressman in either party brave enough to bring my cause to the floor. Having listened with seething disgust to all McHenry reported to us, my eldest son had heard enough. "Mother," Alex said, running a hand through his reddish hair, "we are not to have satisfaction here. Let's go home." Perhaps he had the right of it. And yet, I couldn't convince myself to surrender. The Republicans had killed Alexander Hamilton, and the Federalists wanted to bury him. And now, it seemed, I'd have to fight them all, like the politician my husband had helped me become. Well, if reviving Alexander Hamilton is bad for Federalists at the ballot box, perhaps I might find at least one Republican willing to help me. When I explained my plan, Mac laughed like a leprechaun.
My dear lady, you combine the innocence of the dove with the wisdom of a serpent.
You're certain? My son asked, as if we were to enter a lion's den instead of the whitewashed neoclassical building with iconic pillars that was the president's mansion. I'd been so long in exile from public life that 3 inaugurations had taken place here without my having witnessed them, and the palms of my hands began to sweat. You're Alexander Hamilton's wife, I reminded myself. I was the widow of the man who created this government. I wouldn't allow them to make me feel as if I didn't belong. So I girded my loins to sally forth like a vagabond knight-errant, trusting in Providence for my success. I'm certain. Together, Alex and I alighted the stairs amongst Republican ladies in fashionable high-waisted white gowns and well-dressed gentlemen with gold-buttoned tailcoats, diamond-encrusted watch fobs, and ivory-tipped walking sticks. Whereas I, the wife of the so-called High Pontiff of Federalism, wore only a simple black evening gown. And yet, my resentments at their hypocrisy softened the moment I set eyes upon Dolly Madison, not seated upon a dais where guests might deliberate over how deeply to bow, but in the midst of the sunny yellow damasked parlor, mingling with the crowd. I hadn't been intimate with Dolly in more than 15 years, but it still amused me to recall the day she confided that her passionate and honey-tongued beau was none other than James Madison. Now, in pearl necklace, earrings, and bracelets, with feather-plumed turban, she looked more like a queen than a Quaker. And she was almost pressed to death by people wanting a word with her. Dolly had been mid-conversation when our eyes met, and she broke into an astonished smile that somehow made me instantly glad I'd come. Abandoning her other guests, she rushed to me, taking both my gloved hands. "We're honored by your visit, Mrs. General Hamilton." At the sound of my name, all eyes swiveled to us under the brightly blazing bronze-argand lamps, and I lifted my chin. "Thank you for welcoming me to your levee, Lady Madison." I attempted a curtsy, but Dolly held fast to my hands, refusing to allow it. "We call them drawing rooms now," she corrected gently. "And Lady Madison, goodness, let there be no formality between friends." She said this, of course, to distinguish herself from Martha Washington and Abigail Adams, the supposedly monarchical Federalist ladies who preceded her. But she'd also called me a friend, putting so much emphasis on the word that no one could miss it. "Just who is this handsome young man?" Surprised at the warmth in her gaze, I nodded to Alex, who stood as stiffly at my side as a sentinel on parade. But before I could introduce my son, I caught sight of the president. Oh, how the man had aged. Poor Jemmy Madison had become a withered little apple john, and cut a figure quite at odds with the supposed majesty of the presidency. But if I was startled by Madison's appearance, he seemed even more startled at my son's. Madison had, upon a single glance, abandoned all the important gentlemen in the room to stare at my fair and freckled son as if mesmerized by a face he hadn't seen in years. At the president's approach, I finally did curtsy. "Mr. President, I present my son, Alexander Hamilton, the younger." With an acknowledging nod, as if coming to his senses, Madison grabbed my son's hand and shook it vigorously.
Well met, young Hamilton. I remember when you were only as high as your mother's knee. And look how you've grown. Tell me how you make your way in this world.
In the law, sir, Alex replied. President Madison nodded.
Of course, it would be the law, wouldn't it?
Impudently, Alex said, I'm told it's my inheritance. His only inheritance, he meant. But Madison seemed to miss the bitter implication. And to my surprise, the president's blue eyes crinkled as he smiled.
Indeed, it is your inheritance, young man. I'm sure I don't need to tell you your father possessed intellectual powers of the first order, integrity, and honor in a captivating degree.
To hear this genuine praise for my husband from the lips of a rival was nothing short of astonishing. And the terror that had been coiled inside me in the 6 long years since my husband's death slowly unwound. James Madison will not murder my children. Of that I was sure, and a rush of hope warmed my breast. I hadn't made a mistake in coming here. James Madison was the one Republican I needed. Sir, I said, drawing closer, I've such fond memories of watching you work at my dining room table with my dear Hamilton, in Philadelphia, in New York.
I recall those days very well, madam, the president replied. And all you were obliged to put up with besides, with little children underfoot and all comings and goings at all hours.
We both smiled in remembrance, which emboldened me to mention the biography and ask if he had kept any of my husband's papers. I realize it's a great deal of trouble.
It is no trouble at all, said the president,
promising to deliver copies to me of my husband's notes. I'd not expected this easy agreement. In fact, I worried this would be a promise swiftly forgotten in the frenzy of business that occupied a president's mind. But I was encouraged when Madison put a hand on my son's shoulder and whispered into his ear, And Alex, my always earnest 23-year-old son, actually laughed for the first time in years. He blushed, too, to the tips of his freckled ears, as if the president had said something bawdy. And just like that, Jemmy Madison charmed another of my sons.
Young Hamilton, if the ladies will excuse us, I should like to introduce you to some influential gentlemen.
Both the president's wife and I quickly nodded our assent. Then Dolly looped her arm through mine as we watched the men go. How like Hamilton he looks. I only smiled, suddenly too emotional to speak. And how swiftly they grow up. My little Payne is 18 now, no longer banging on copper pots, but causing trouble all the same at his boarding school. I laughed. With 5 sons and all the orphans now under my care, I'm well acquainted with such antics.
Indeed. Dolly said, with a sigh that reminded me she'd never been able to give Madison the gift of a child after all.
Then, as if to shake herself free of that disappointment, she said,
Let me show you the president's mansion.
With that, Dolly led me into the oval room, where I expected to see French furniture, an homage to the revolution the Jeffersonians so admired. Instead, I found the style very different.
Greek, I guessed.
Dolly's plume bobbed with her nod.
Yes, because the Greeks were free. Every citizen thought himself an important part of the Republic.
A sentiment that I would never argue against.
Do you see those curtains?
I nodded because I could scarcely fail to notice the vivid red velvet draperies that so dramatically gave the impression of blazing splendor. Dolly ran her fingertips over the soft fabric.
I insisted on these, over every man's objections. I've become quite the libertine, and I suppose I have you to thank for encouraging me to embrace my destiny as Mr. Madison's wife.
She seemed much happier in her role as First Lady than any of her predecessors, and much happier, I knew, than I would have been in her place. So I didn't hesitate to tell her a story that was making the rounds. "Do you know what our Federalist candidate said when asked how he lost the election to your husband?" Dolly stiffened, as if expecting a partisan barb, but my story was a compliment. "He said, 'I was beaten by Mr. and Mrs. Madison. I might have had a better chance if I faced Mr. Madison alone.'" We laughed at that together, and we sat for quite a while reminiscing. There was once a time when Dolly was the needy widow and I'd helped her. Now I hoped she'd help me in return. I'd prepared an argument. Partisans would accuse me of greed, assuming that Alexander had stolen so much money from the treasury that I must now be living in luxury. I couldn't admit my husband had died deeply in debt, and even if I did admit it, the most rabid Republicans might deny my request for a veteran's benefits out of spite. So I confided to Dolly only, "My farmland provides me no more than $750 a year, and though I have a roof over my children's head and food in their bellies, we're beholden to the generosity of others. In exchange for the service my husband provided this government, does it not seem just that his children are recompensed?" "Congress will take a hard line against you," Dolly said thoughtfully, as if the president had little influence with Congress. Perhaps he did not. Madison was not, like Jefferson, a tall and handsome politician of immense if wily charm. And he seemed already to be having trouble steering Congress. Madison was once my husband's most fierce opponent in the establishment of a national bank. But he'd since come to realize its necessity, yet partisans in Congress were determined to let it lapse. Perhaps it was ill-advised for me to ask the president to use his influence on a private matter when he was fighting larger battles. But he wouldn't have had to fight them if he hadn't thrown in with Jefferson in the first place. "I'm a widow of a war hero," I said stoutly, "and more than that. General Hamilton might have made a fortune in private life, but he gave his best energies to his country." And because I believed that Dolly, as a political wife, would understand, I added, "We both spent the better part of our lives in service to this nation. And what do I have to show for it?" The expression of the president's wife melted in unmistakable sympathy. But before she could reply, someone called to her. A jowled woman who mimicked Dolly's fashion sense, wearing a fur-lined cape and turban, charged our way. It was Margaret Bayard Smith, the not-so-secret author of her husband's influential Washington newspaper, the Daily National Intelligencer. "I shouldn't neglect her," Dolly said. But before Dolly took her leave, I whispered, "Is my cause hopeless?"
"Not if you know the right ears to whisper into," she said, "and fortunately, I do."
Then, excusing herself, she left my side. And I didn't blame her. I could easily imagine what mischief might be sown for the Madisons, and for myself, by a report that the wife of a Republican newspaper man had been snubbed in favor of Hamilton's widow. Relief stole over me. And hope, too, until I found myself staring across the room into the startled gray eyes of the man just recently appointed as Secretary of State, James Monroe. Haltingly, Monroe made his way through the press of bodies to stand before me.
"Mrs. General Hamilton," he said,
that infuriating dimple still upon the chin of his now thinner face, as he awaited acknowledgement at our unexpected reunion. But what could I possibly have to say to this man? A decade had passed since I'd left Monroe searching for his conscience, and as best as I could tell, he'd never found it. He'd lost it to ambition. Not hollow ambition like Burr's, for that assassin never had a conscience to lose in the first place, but a weighty ambition, that grew heavier in the shadow of his fellow Virginians, Washington, Jefferson, and Madison. James Monroe hungered for the presidency and became even more of an embittered partisan when Jefferson promoted Madison and not himself as heir apparent. "What did you expect from a man like Jefferson?" I wanted to say. "You gave your friendship and loyalty to a man who didn't cherish it. Not as I once cherished it." A thing I remembered with clarity when, as if unsteadied by my presence, Monroe dabbed sweat upon his upper lip with an embroidered kerchief. This kerchief was finer than the one he'd given me all those years ago. That one I'd kept as a talisman against insecurity and sadness when I first learned of my husband's infidelity. And even after Alexander and I reconciled, I'd kept Monroe's kerchief as a sentimental token of friendship. In truth, I'd quite forgotten it until this moment, because after our last confrontation over his role in the exposure of the Reynolds affair, I'd not wished to remember Monroe at all. But now, here he was, waiting for me to say something polite, such as, "Why, hello, Mr. Monroe, it's been too long. I hope your family is well." I told myself it wouldn't cost me very much to say it. In fact, it might help me. If James Monroe were to take up my banner, Congress might reinstate my husband's benefits. After all, Monroe was a veteran and a favorite son amongst the rank-and-file Republicans. They might listen to him more than the president. And after having broken his word of honor to me as a gentleman, didn't Monroe owe me a debt? Perhaps that's what I should say to him, I thought. But in the end, I was a Schuyler as much as I was a Hamilton. And though words had been my husband's weapon, silence had often been mine. So I said nothing at all to James Monroe. Instead, I gave him the cut direct and turned to find my son. "Alexander," I called, making rare use of his full name. "Yes, mother," Alex asked, rushing to my side. I glanced back at Monroe and enjoyed the flinch of recognition that settled onto the Virginian's face at seeing my boy, as if seeing a ghost. "I think we've accomplished our purpose here," I said, letting Alex escort me away. And I vowed that I'd burn Monroe's forgotten kerchief upon our return home. It would take years before my husband's benefits were finally and quietly reinstated. But I knew, without question, who I had to thank for it. Madison had been our friend. Madison had been our partner. And Madison was good to his word about my husband's papers, too, sending copies for the biography. I had tilted at a windmill and won. Chapter 39. I would willingly risk my life, though not my character, to exalt my station. I wish there was a war.
Alexander Hamilton. October 1810, New York City. My sons were all in rebellion. I returned from Washington City triumphantly, with arms full of notes and documents for the biography, only to learn that in defiance of my wishes, 22-year-old James had decided to marry his sweetheart. I suppose it was the Schuyler in him. It wasn't that I disapproved of his young lady. It was simply that, as a law clerk, James wasn't yet established in the legal practice he was pursuing. Fortunately, Mary was a sweet girl who claimed to relish the position of wife to an impoverished young man, and I saw the wisdom in my father's old admonition that it was sometimes best to frown, make them humble, and forgive. Besides, it wasn't only James who was in rebellion. At Christmas, Alex told me he would sail to Europe.
"You needn't worry about the expense. My cousin Flip and I are going together, and Uncle Church has loaned us the money."
Having denied my eldest surviving son the opportunity to make a merchant's career in Boston, I wouldn't now prevent him from exploring across the sea. For years, Alex had remained at my side, dutifully and uncomplainingly toiling in the law to support me and his siblings. No mother could ask more, and he'd earned a respite. But what he said next chilled me to the bone.
I'm going to volunteer with the Duke of Wellington to fight Napoleon Bonaparte on the peninsula.
Alex wanted to go to war. For England. Horrified, I said, "You're an American."
His spine stiffened. I haven't forgotten. But when we were in Washington City, President Madison said I should take the opportunity to write to him. If I can report back to him on the goings-on in Europe.
Alex, I said, more upset by the moment.
He took my hand. Mother, there's no way for a Hamilton to make his name in American politics. Business was foreclosed to me once I abandoned my position in Boston. That leaves only the battlefield. My father was a general. My grandfather was a general. Heroes, both of them, you've always told me. How can I want to be anything else?
How could he want to be anything else, indeed? Alex had the right to determine his own fate. His father had fought for that principle, and I would uphold it. So the following spring, I stood bravely next to Angelica at the docks as we tearfully saw our sons off to a war on foreign shores, grateful that they were at least together. Just as we'd always been. And a year later, Angelica and I were still together, worrying about our sons and taking coffee at the Tontine, as was our habit, while all the talk around us was of the war coming to our own shores. Because the British had never stopped visiting humiliations upon American ships, seizing them and impressing our soldiers, behaving as if we'd never won our War of Independence and were still merely a rebellious set of colonies. This was the chatter of passers-by that swirled around us while we warmed our hands against our coffee cups at the curbside table. My sister took hers with sugar and cream and always ordered a pastry that she never touched, saying she'd eaten too large a breakfast before offering it to me. I'm not a starving urchin, I said, though those were indeed lean times. If anything, you're the one growing too thin. There was a fragility to her delicate features that had never been there before. Worry over Flip, no doubt. Our fear for our boys was always present, even when we gave it no voice. Maybe especially then. I don't want to grow as stout as Mama did, Angelica said, pushing the plate to me. I intend to fight for my beauty to the bitter end. Surrendering, I savored a sweet morsel of the pastry. I believe your vanity is overcoming good sense. You're the one to speak of good sense. You forget I have spies in your household. She did. My children told their beloved Aunt Angelica everything. And what do they report? That you're considering a foolhardy trip into the wilds of western New York to visit an Indian school? It wasn't just an Indian school, as she had good cause to know. It was the Hamilton Oneida Academy that my husband helped to found for the advancement of our Indian allies, the plight of whom was always dear to my heart. It's soon to be chartered as Hamilton College, and I don't see why I should not be present for its christening. Because it's a ghastly journey, Angelica said with a sniff. The only way my son could persuade me to visit western New York was to name a town after me. Before he left for England, Flip had done that, to the not-so-secret delight of his mother. Of course, your wanderlust is far less concerning than the other report I've received, that you spend hours upon your knees sorting through boxes of dusty papers like a madwoman. I gulped at my coffee and shrugged. I'm looking for Alexander's draft of Washington's farewell address. It's as important a contribution as anything else he ever wrote, and if I can find his notes, I can prove it. Maybe he didn't keep notes, Angelica said, or perhaps he sent them to someone for safekeeping. I think someone took them, I replied. But I couldn't stay to elaborate because a glance down at the timepiece suspended from my needlework chatelaine told me I ought to leave soon to interview a new teacher for the orphanage. My son Johnny was to escort me, and he was seldom late. But on that day, he sauntered to our table slowly and sat beside us with a certain gravity. At 19, Johnny was a gentle, bookish student of literature. Of all my sons, he was the last I might ever suspect would announce that he was to join the military. But he said, "As the son of Alexander Hamilton, I cannot shirk my duty." So it was that I lost my eldest sons all at once to the Hamiltonian desire to rise up on the tide of war. March, 1814, New York City. It was called the War of 1812, though most of the fighting took place after that year. They also called it the Second War for Independence, and a new generation of Hamiltons were fighting it. My battle-hardened Alex returned from Europe to serve as a captain in the U.S. infantry. James commanded a New York militia brigade. Johnny served as aide-de-camp to Major General William Henry Harrison, and 17-year-old William, a wild and lanky mischief-maker whose indifference to his studies and to wearing shoes would have snapped even his indulgent father's patience, now trained to be an officer at West Point. Angelica's son had returned to fight for America, too. "When our boys come for a visit, we'll have a veritable army at our table," she said. We'd just left Sunday service at Trinity Church to stroll, taking our exercise in the brisk air, and I remembered a long-ago night when I'd had another veritable army around a platter of steaming waffles at my table. Alexander, Monroe, and Aaron Burr. Which brought me to my purpose in haunting the occupant of a little office on Nassau Street. It had come to our attention that the tiny tin placard on the door reading "Mr. A. Arnott, Esquire," was actually an assumed name for Burr, who'd returned to the city after a decade of exile. After so many years, the criminal charges against him had been dropped, and now it seemed the younger generation didn't remember him. Or what he'd done. But I remembered. Burr might have chosen any other city in America, but he'd chosen to return to mine. So whenever I passed Burr's shabby little door and saw any person about to knock, I'd call, "Oh, is that your solicitor? You should know that he murdered my husband." Soon after I made a habit of this, Burr changed the placard on his door to Mr. Edwards, and I wondered what name I'd force him to adopt next. If I could take satisfaction in nothing else, I smiled to think I'd deprived him of a name, the thing my husband died for. "If it's your purpose to make him a miserable recluse," Angelica said as we walked, "I'm told you're succeeding." Burr's grandson had died of a childhood illness the previous year. Then his daughter was lost at sea. He was left alone, without family, severed from the human race. I wasn't monstrous enough to take joy in these tragedies. Some days I even wondered if these tragedies may have shaken loose some morsel of a soul, so that Burr now understood what he'd inflicted upon me. Other days I had the absurd thought he might open his office door as we passed and beg my forgiveness. But he never did. He was hiding from the world. He was hiding from me. On this day, I peered at the bare, snow-dusted window in search of a glimpse of that crooked man in the shadows. But while I was looking, I felt my sister grasp my arm. "Betsy," she whispered, and I turned to see her go pale as death. Then, before I could steady her, my sister's knees buckled, and she collapsed onto the icy street. "Angelica," I cried, dropping to my knees beside her. As she sprawled, gasping and staring at the sky, I feared that she'd knocked her head or broken a bone. I called for help, and some part of me dreaded that Burr might emerge from his office to lend assistance. but it was actually the Reverend Mason who happened by and helped me convey Angelica back to the warmth of her own house. "All this for beauty?" I asked, furious when she confessed that she'd simply not eaten that day, hunger the probable reason for her swoon. "Anxiety of the war leaves me no appetite," she protested weakly. But 2 days later, in a state of delirium, her hair plastered with sweat to a ghostly white face, she whispered, "Don't tell Betsy." I'd come to tend her with a basket of tonics and herbs, but my brother-in-law, in shirt sleeves and dishevelment, stood stone-faced in the entryway of her bedroom. "She's been unwell. She didn't wish for you to know."
"Unwell? What can you mean?"
"Cancerous tumors," Church replied stiffly. It was several agonizing moments before I could take a breath.
"Where have the tumors arisen?"
I finally had the clarity to ask. Sometimes tumors could be surgically removed, a painful and gruesome procedure, but one with a chance for survival. As if he knew what I was thinking, Church shook his head and rubbed his unshaven jaw. "They can't be cut away."
Which meant
Angelica was dying. My gaze flew past him to where my once vivacious sister lay withered and frail in her bed, moaning softly in pain. And I could do nothing to help her. I was again to lose someone I loved better than myself, and the crushing weight of our impending separation made me grasp at the doorframe for balance. Helplessly, I looked into the eyes of my brother-in-law.
"How long has she been suffering?"
"Quite some time."
"Quite some time."
She'd been sick and fearful and hadn't told me. She'd told her husband, but not me, and I resented him, though I had no right.
"Why didn't she tell me?"
"She didn't wish you to see her this way, with her mind lost to the laudanum and..."
"I don't care," I hissed. "You will not dare keep me away. You do not dare."
He didn't, especially since Angelica was soon out of her bed, making little of her illness, putting off my tearful inquiries with teasing. But now that my eyes were open, I saw the laudanum glitter of her eyes, the exhaustion of her thinning body. She quipped that she would be dancing at a ball in no time. But that attack of weakness in the street had been some catalyst of a terrible kind, because she was soon bedridden, and I found it both a cruelty and a mercy that my irrepressible sister was not long bound in the struggle of dying. When she awakened one morning to find me at her bedside, she took my hand and kissed it.
"My dear Eliza, it's only right that I die before you. I'm the oldest. I should have gone before Peggy. I should go before you. Besides, I am a sinner and you are a saint."
"No, Angelica," I said, shaking my head in denial and anger at the Lord himself. My sister had been my touchstone, before and after my husband's death. In the worst days of my grief, I couldn't have remained standing without her steadfast support. And now, the only pain worse than the knowledge she was to be taken from me was pity that she should suffer so much. But closing her eyes, Angelica said,
"Envy me, my sweet sister, for a merciful God is taking me to see all our lost loved ones."
Then her pain became too great to bear. We dosed her, and under the laudanum spell, she spoke as if she were still a girl leading our troop of children in Albany.
"Go, Blues."
Sometimes she imagined herself a young mother again, singing lullabies to her babies. Or a high society lady in France, confiding gossip about nobles, long since beheaded. Other times she said strange and haunting words about things that never happened at all. But mostly, as she died, it was the same torturous refrain.
"Don't tell Betsy, don't tell Betsy."
Then, finally, frantically and heartbreakingly,
"Don't tell Betsy, Alexander. Never confess it."
Not even if I am dead.
It was only the laudanum, I told myself in the days after Angelica's death. After all the other losses I'd suffered, I'd always found some way to get up, get dressed, feed the children, go to church, and work in the causes the Lord had pointed out to me as a sacred duty. But not this time. Even though it worried my children. My youngest daughter, 14-year-old Lisbeth, climbed into the bed next to me.
Mama, it's past noon, she chided, trying to rouse me.
I reached for her and tucked a braid of hair behind her ear, even though the sight of her struck me with an arrow of bittersweet pain. Lisbeth had my nut-brown complexion, Alexander's auburn hair, and her Aunt Angelica's features. I had the disturbing thought that she was a perfect amalgamation, as if she'd been born from the three of us. It was only the laudanum, I told myself again. People said strange things under its influence. Dying people said strange things without laudanum. One could scarcely be held to account for murmurs halfway between this life and the next. That I should fixate upon my sister's dying words with dark suspicion was surely some madness of grief. Yet I didn't cry for my beautiful, brilliant sister. I didn't cut clippings of Angelica's hair. I couldn't think what the point of it might be, what the point of anything was. Perhaps God knew, but I did not. All I felt was a slow, calm suffocation under the avalanche of relentless losses that started with my son and would not end until I, myself, found oblivion. Which was why I didn't wish to rise from the warm cocoon of my blankets. My heart felt in the throes of reverse metamorphosis, where the butterfly was to fold its wings and become the ugly, misshapen worm. Was this Christian resignation at last? With her head upon my pillow, Lisbeth murmured, Aunt Angelica must be buried, but Uncle Church, well, he won't, he can't. That's what finally roused me. The shocking discovery that my brother-in-law couldn't afford, or simply refused to pay for, a fitting sepulcher for Angelica in Trinity Churchyard. Though he'd wooed and won a patriot's daughter, made his fortune supplying an American army, and was the father of children in this country, Church intended to return to England. He said he couldn't endure the pain of living in a place where he'd be confronted with the memories of his beloved wife. And I believed him. For Church, too, had been at his wife's side when she whispered my husband's name. It was only the laudanum, I insisted, wondering where I'd find the strength and money to do for my sister what Church could not or would not. As it happened, it was Kitty Livingston, of all people, who offered to let my sister rest in the Livingston family vault, not far from where my husband and son were buried. After church services and without looking at me, Kitty straightened her gloves and said, Your family may be Federalists, but I have, over a lifetime, grown accustomed to having the Schuyler sisters near me, and I'm too old and set in my ways now to wish for a change. Kitty was, as always, some strange combination of mean and magnanimous. An example of how virtue and vice could live inside a person side by side. She was a living embodiment of how I could still be surprised by people I'd known most of my life, or even from the moment I was born. After the funeral, my brother-in-law said, Take what you like of her belongings. He sat on a chest at the foot of Angelica's bed, a drunk, unkept stranger amidst her intimate things, a brush and a gilded mirror left casually upon the dressing table, bottles of perfume and pots of cosmetics, ribbons and silk stockings, and ornaments that she'd treasured. Angelica had exquisite taste. Any item that belonged to her was likely to fetch a price, and my brother-in-law ought to have them valued. At the very least, he should save something sentimental for their children. That he seemed not to have thought of it made me wish to take it all,
Everything from portraits to pearls to the silver nutmeg grater my sister had purchased in London. I thought to keep my sister's elegant hats and dresses for Lisbeth, her leather-bound books, which spanned such a range of intellectual subjects from science to finance, knowing that my sons could benefit from them. Yet what I wanted most was a painted chest with a bronze latch where, for many years now, Angelica had kept her correspondence neatly folded and wrapped in white silk to keep the broken wax seals from sticking. "I would be grateful to select a few things for my children," I said to Church, though I was wary that he might find my next request a terrible intrusion. "But most of all, I'd like to look at her letters." He only gave a bleak shrug, the light gone from his once shining eyes. "As I said, take whatever you like." It was only the laudanum. I wanted to shout at him. I wanted to scream it and shake him, or reach for his hands and reassure my brother-in-law that the people we loved would never have betrayed us, that to let memories of Angelica and Alexander be stained with suspicions was an evil, a sin. For almost 40 years, I'd called John Barker Church my brother, but there had always been a wall separating us. At first, only a little overgrown hedge of jealousy for having won my sister's love and attention and carrying her away. Then, upon learning of his secret identity and his marital troubles, I'd wondered about the character of such a man. But most of all, as I found him at the center of nearly every tragedy in my life, a fortification of resentment built between us, stone upon stone. And now, there was no crossing that barrier. So I didn't offer him comfort or accept any. Instead, I opened the box. We think we know the people we love. We think that love gives us more than a glimpse into one another's souls. But the idea that human beings are knowable is one of the many lies we tell in the service of love. That's what I learned reading my sister's letters. For I hadn't appreciated that in her correspondence with princes, philosophers, and statesmen, that she commanded their respect, as well as their lustful fascination. And I hadn't known that in spite of countless letters from esteemed persons, including George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Charles James Fox, and Lafayette, only one bundle of letters did she keep separate. One bundle lay wrapped in a lace garter, with a memorial ring enclosing a tiny braid of auburn hair I knew so well. Alexander's hair. Alexander's letters. And as for the garter, I recognized it, for my sister had worn it to Washington's inaugural ball. It was the garter that she said had slipped from her thigh while she was dancing, and my husband gallantly swept it from the floor to spare her embarrassment. Angelica had teased that she couldn't make him a knight of the garter in this new country of ours, where we didn't make such distinctions. And Kitty had confronted me in the middle of the ball, insisting that Peggy had said, "He'd be a knight of your bedchamber if he could." Peggy denied it. But was it not precisely the sort of thing that Peggy would have blurted out? More importantly, Angelica had kept the garter, wrapped closely around treasured letters. And what to make of the ring? I hadn't given it to her. Had she made it herself as a memorial after his death, or as a token of remembrance during his life? I dreaded to find the answer. Knowing for quite some time of her impending death, surely she would have burned any letters that might have led to painful revelations. But perhaps the reckless girl who'd crept out of our father's house to run off with a beau, not caring whether it might cost Papa sleep, his rank, or even the war, was too selfish to burn what she treasured, no matter the pain it might cause. "Stop this," I told myself, thumbing through the pages. The flirtation between my sister and my husband had been a private jest among the three of us. I'd encouraged it. I'd read my husband's letters to Angelica before he sent them. I'd watched him write them. At least once he'd asked me to deliver a letter to her personally so that his waggery wouldn't cause eyebrows to lift amongst those who didn't share our little joke. And when Angelica's letters arrived in the post, we read them together. There could be nothing secret or untoward in any of them, I reassured myself. But now, to my dismay, I found that I hadn't seen all the letters. Once, when his hands were cramped writing the Federalist, Alexander somehow had found the time to write a letter to Angelica that taunted her flirtatiously about the misplacement of a comma. I seldom write to a lady without fancying the relation of lover and mistress, he began, adding in closing that I sent my love. But never had I set eyes on this letter. Surely I would have remembered. There is no proof of my affection which I would not willingly give you, he wrote my sister a few months before he took Mrs. Reynolds to our bed. And another, later that year, while he was still bedding that harlot. You hurt my republican nerves, Angelica, by your intimacy with princes, while I can only console myself by thinking of you. Each letter brought new pain, and I held my breath upon opening every one. Your sister consents to everything, except that I should love you as well as herself, and this you are too reasonable to expect, my husband wrote. But I hadn't consented to this. What had Alexander been capable of? This man I'd loved and honored? He was capable of betraying our marriage bed. And I knew, from the stories Angelica told me of her time in Europe, that my sister might have been capable of betraying her husband, too. Perhaps even with Jefferson, no less. And another thing I knew, had always known, was that at the heart of my husband's infidelity with Mrs. Reynolds was the base motive of revenge. If Alexander could be jealous of my sister's intimacy with princes, I could well imagine his feelings upon knowing that Jefferson may have been smitten with her. Was my sister's favor another battleground over which the two men fought? It was only the laudanum, I told myself, now desperate to believe it. But my heart was in shadow and could not see light. Angelica herself once wrote me, "You know I love your husband very much, and if you were as generous as the old Romans, you would lend him to me a little while." Could she have helped herself to him and kept it secret? My sister was good at schemes and secrets. And of course, my husband had kept secrets the entirety of our marriage, even and perhaps especially in the last days of his life. At some point or another, both of them hid from me the most vital things, as if I were a child. And perhaps I had been. Even Monroe had an inkling of something untoward between my sister and my husband early in our marriage. Was it any wonder that he could believe my husband guilty of any sort of corruption thereafter? I remembered now that the very first time my husband was ever accused of adultery in print was that same spring that Angelica came to New York without her husband. When I'd pushed them together, insisting that Alexander squire her about the city to mend her broken heart. I'd allowed my sister to play hostess to Alexander and his gentleman friends and been grateful for it. I'd allowed my sister to take my place. Sweet, stupid Eliza. Still the fool. Always the fool. And now I was left to wonder. Who were Alexander and Angelica? Who were they really? Chapter 40. June 1814. Harlem.
How will you get on here by yourself, Mother?
William asked while I unlatched the shutters to let fresh air into the long-neglected house at the Grange. On leave from the academy at West Point, my nearly 17-year-old son had worked himself into a lather, carting chairs and lamps and personal items into the house. But now, red-faced and dripping with sweat, William looked ready to pack it all back into a wagon if I should change my mind. None of my sons approved of my decision to move to the home we once more owned, away from the city, our friends, and my work at the orphanage.